Hey everyone, Johan Marino, the host of the Inside Transportation podcast here. And I just want to make sure you guys are aware that we are hosting our Future of Transportation, a virtual event this Thursday, hosted by myself and Inside.com. We're going to be hearing from some of the top companies that are pushing the envelope to what's possible in the transportation space. We are going to have a very exciting roster of speakers, including Will Coleman, the CEO and founder of Alto. They're a ride-hailing company that is trying to improve the experience for both drivers and passengers. Justin Lang, who is the head of partnerships and corporate strategy for Joby Aviation, their VTOL company. Ben Baer, the chief business officer for Spin. We're also going to have David Madej, who is the VP of Global Business Development for Aurora Innovation. We're also going to be doing a Q&A at the end of the presentation, so you can actually ask the speakers any questions you may have. We're also going to be having a networking piece as well through our Slack channel. So if you want to join us, please go to events.insight.com. This is a free event. Yes, free. Absolutely free. Join us. Register events.insight.com. And now on to the show. Hello and welcome to the Inside Transportation Podcast, a production of Inside.com. This is our weekly podcast where we discuss transportation trends that you need to know about to stay ahead of the curve. My name is Johan Marino. My co-host Jason is out today, but no worries. We have a guest that I'm incredibly excited to talk to today. On today's podcast, well, on this podcast in general, we talk about the revolutions happening in transportation mobility, things like flying cars, electric vehicles, and the like. But believe it or not, many essential American industries rely on railroads to transport goods. Without railroads, American firms and consumers would be unable to participate in the global economy anywhere near as fully as they do today. But as with any industry, there are challenges, threats, competitors, and innovation in the space. Here to tell us more about it, we have the man, I would say, Ian Jeffries, the president and CEO of the Association of American Railroads. As the Association of American Railroads president and CEO, Jeffries advocates for and works with member railroads to ensure the continued viability of America's railroad industry. Without further ado, Ian, thanks for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Johan. And I think I can say unequivocally that is the first time I've ever been introduced as the man. So
you are
the
man.
I like it. Yeah,
If we want to learn more about the railroads, I would say the president and CEO of the Association of American Railroads is the man who can give us some of these insights.
Well, that's the goal today, so I'll do my best.
There you go. So many of our listeners work in high-tech industries. I mean, you know, this is a very much Silicon Valley-style podcast, and they may be wondering, why are freight railroads or railways essential to my business? How are they relevant to me at all in my life? Why don't you explain a little bit more about the role of freight railroads in our modern society?
Absolutely. So I think we should just start with, regardless of who you are, where you are, the goods in your home, the materials used to build your home, the car you're driving, anything you rely on in your day-to-day life that is tangible, most likely either spent time being transported by rail or components of that spent time being transported by rail. Basically, everything around us that we see every day, most likely some facet of that has spent time being transported by freight rail. And so we are an industry that for many folks, you know, we aren't front of mind. We aren't consumer facing generally. You know, we're not trucks, we're not planes, we're not cars, but our economy and our country and our communities rely on freight railroads as much, if not just as much as any other industry out there, without maybe ever realizing the extent to which we rely on that. And for those that are focused on tech or working on tech, I think they would be absolutely astounded to realize the technological advancements that have occurred in the freight rail industry over the past several decades. Yes, it's still steel on steel. It's always going to be steel on steel. But locomotives you see today are literally rolling supercomputers. They're self-diagnostic, rolling across a network of sensors and detectors that are constantly evaluating the health of the rail that trains are going over, of the cars and the locomotives that are going over the rail. We're largely operating in I wouldn't go so far to say as autopilot mode, but very much a I would say a cruise control mode of transportation. Today's locomotives are, you know, they're determining their own speed to maximize fuel efficiency. They're monitoring the trip compliance plans to ensure that that all rules are being followed, and can override a human's control of the system if the human is breaking work rules. So really, what we have is a smart network of railroads out there now, and it's really cool to be a part of it right now.
Yeah. So this actually segues into this question that I have. What is some innovation that's currently being developed behind the scenes in the railroad industry that we'll see in 5 to 10 years kind of fully develop out there in the marketplace that's going to entirely change how rail operates?
Right. So I think where we're going, you need to look at where we've been and where we are right now. So one, probably the biggest technological undertaking that the rail industry has had in its history has occurred over the past 13 years. It's a development of a system called Positive Train Control, which is basically a nationwide telecom network on the railroads that, again, it goes back to what I was saying, that governs a railroad's operations. So it's automatically tracking what the work rules are, what the speed limits are, and if an engineer that's up in the cab of the railroad is not abiding by those rules, it will take over and shut the system down. It's basically a massive safety technology to avoid the most catastrophic types of incidents. So Positive Train Control has been absolutely a game changer in the industry and a long time coming. Something that was just a massive endeavor by the industry that we just really got full installation, full implementation at the end of last year after over a decade of extremely hard work and technological development. But what that's going to do is really, it will be the backbone of future technological innovation. As I said, we have basically Positive Train Control runs over the most dense routes across the country. So that's about 60,000 miles of rail line where the bulk of rail volumes travel on. What we have now is this state-of-the-art telecom network that's been built out. So that is basically a spine on which we can continue to deploy new technologies. And so I mentioned various types of sensors and detectors that are out across the network. So what we're talking about is autonomous track inspection tools that are evaluating the interior health of the rail that a train is going over as the train is going over it to identify any flaws that may be developing before they become a risk level that could result in some sort of rail breakage or that could lead to an incident. So we're constantly developing tools like that to assess the health and maximize the safety of the railroad. But also what that's doing is just every day gathering terabytes of data and allowing our companies to really start to look at deploying predictive analytics, to deploy AI into the system to really begin to be able to predict when failure might occur in a system, or when you start kind of going from the green light to the yellow light of the condition of part of the track or structure or train or bridge, because again we're a heavy industry, and so safety has to be at the highest possible level. And all of these tools and using technology in these tools is allowing us to go leaps and bounds further than we've been able to do. On the locomotive side, because you mentioned electric, locomotives, what we're seeing right now out in California especially is in revenue service, we're seeing development and deployment of EV hybrid locomotives. So I think that's something, alternative fuel locomotives, that you'll really see in the next decade start to gain some traction as well.
Wow, that's great. I mean, I think this concept of positive train control is incredibly interesting. Do you think these are the ground, this is the groundwork that the industry had to do if there's a future for autonomous trains. Do you see autonomous trains ever coming into the freight and passenger rail space? Has there been any work with the railroads, with some of these companies that are developing technology for automotive, like Waymo and the like? Any insights there?
So positive train control is absolutely the framework for additional autonomous technologies, because positive train control in and of itself is an autonomous capability that's been installed into the railroads. So right now on many of our railroads, once the train is up and running, it is largely running autonomously with of course, you know, an engineer at the helm and the locomotive kind of managing the process. So that is 100% within reach, I would say, much sooner than later. And of course, you're deploying and borrowing from technologies in over the road vehicles, but rail is actually a much simpler way to achieve these outcomes that companies like Waymo and others have been working so hard at making such progress on, because we're on a fixed guideway that's largely closed right. off from anything else. So really, it's just about, you know, speed control and you know, stopping and starting at the right time, and again, taking steps to kind of optimize your fuel usage. And so we've achieved quite a few of those gains and those realities already. And so full autonomous capability is really within reach and not that far away.
As far as
technological.
Are any of your partner railways, you know, interested in doing that, you know, around, let's say, before 2025? Do you have like a ballpark range there?
So I think there's absolutely enthusiasm for realizing those technological capabilities in everyday train service across, you know, our what's called our main lines, like I said, where most of the traffic flows. I will tell you, you know, we are a fully collectively bargained industry. So we have 13 different labor groups that we work with. So that's a very important piece of that, is working with our unions and with our employees as we continue to evolve how we operate. And so any development towards purely autonomous or reduced reliance on human operation, of course, is going to have to be done hand in hand with our labor unions we work with. But there's absolutely enthusiasm out there. The industry is, like I said, it's evolving at a rapid clip, and the capability is within reach and within closer reach than I would say other industries out there. Again, because we have we're operating on a closed fixed guideway. So it's a pretty, you know, in the grand scheme of things, I don't want to use the word simple at all, because there's nothing simple yeah. about any of this, but, you know, not having to interact there's a much smaller number of uncertainties that need to be addressed versus, you know, a truck driving through a crowded highway or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll talk more about infrastructure and, you know, labor as we kind of keep going into this conversation.
Hey, everybody, I just want to let you know that this episode of Inside Transportation is sponsored by our friends at the Ford Motor Company, built on the belief that freedom of movement drives human progress from connectivity to autonomy. Ford has one simple goal, and that's to improve the mobility of its customers. Ford has been using technology to shape the future of transportation for over 100 years and is dedicated to solving the world's most pressing mobility issues. What you might not know is that Ford has a series of divisions that make these visions a reality. Ford X is Ford's venture incubator that unites entrepreneurs, designers, and engineers to shape the future of transportation. Ford's City Innovations team brings innovative ideas to life through community workshops, crowdsourcing initiatives, and citywide mobility challenges. And Spin, a property of Ford, brings e-scooter sharing to cities and college campuses. So here's your call to action. To learn more about Ford's work in mobility, autonomous vehicles, and their global efforts to improve mobility for its customers, visit corporate.ford.com. That's corporate.ford.com.
One thing I wanted to ask you, because I know many of our listeners are probably familiar with passenger rail. Mm-hmm. They might not be as familiar with freight rail. What would you say is the split in revenue between freight rail and passenger rail, just to show the impact that freight rail represents?
So freight rail is almost exclusively privately owned and operated in this country, and freight rail pays for and maintains its own infrastructure. So we're talking roughly $25, $26 billion in private capital put back into the freight rail network every year, which is about a 140,000-mile network. And so the main difference is right there. It's that freight rail, privately owned, operated, where passenger rail is generally largely publicly subsidized and relying on not just the fare box revenues, but also either state, local, or federal contributions to support the operation of passenger.
Yeah, I was going to say, it is super interesting, doing some research with the industry, that there is actually no public funding that, and you can confirm with me on freight rail, that there is no public funds that actually go to improving the efficiency of these systems. I mean, just speaking as a, representative for these agencies or for these companies, what type of rail infrastructure improvements would you like to see the government kind of collaborate with, your railways to improve efficiency? Because at the end of the day, I mean, having a robust rail system helps everyone out in our grand right. scheme of transportation, especially when you consider that, you're competing with the trucking industry, correct?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's kind of there's several prongs to that answer. So, first of all, I would say our members are extremely proud of the fact that we do it on our own, so to speak, that mm-hmm. we pay for and maintain our own infrastructure. Where the government plays an important role with regard to freight infrastructure, we are involved in some public-private partnerships. For example, the city of Chicago is home to just an immense amount of rail, both passenger and freight rail. Something like 25% of freight rail traffic runs through Chicago on a daily basis from across the country. And yeah. So you have just a dense mishmash and crisscross of tracks throughout the area. And so some of those tracks are publicly owned passenger, some of those are privately owned freight. And we've gotten involved in a number of public-private partnerships to separate those tracks, to allow flyovers and separate grade crossings, to really enable a much more efficient movement of goods in what is a very high traffic, high volume area. So the feds certainly play a productive role there and helping fund our public partners in these types of projects. And mm-hmm. so that's something that we're enthusiastic about. There's a good role there and certainly something that should be encouraged and should continue. Passenger rail is in substantial need of robust public investment. I know you're working out of California. If we go mm-hmm. over to the East Coast, really the passenger rail network, Amtrak's network from Washington, D.C. up to New York, That is owned by Amtrak, the Northeast Corridor.
Right.
It is an immensely successful passenger rail corridor. I believe passenger rail has about 75% of the share of trips between plane and train between Washington and New York. So out of 100 people who are either flying or taking the train, 75 of them are taking the train and 25 of them are flying. It's just
so much more convenient.
Yeah, it is. It's a huge asset. But yeah. At the same time, that stretch of traffic it's old. It needs about $40 to $50 billion of public investment to get it just up to a state of good repair. Never mind take it to next generation, high-speed rail, which is what everyone's desire is. So to me, there's a very real need for robust federal investment into passenger projects and passenger-owned assets like that. But I'll tell you, you mentioned our friends in the trucking industry who operate over a highway system that is historically was supported by user fees. So gas tax, et cetera, used to almost exclusively pay for our highway system. Well, the gas tax hasn't kept up with the rate of inflation, the cost of maintenance. So we've seen about $140 billion in general fund transfers into what's called the Highway Trust Fund over the past 10 years. And for privately owned freight rail, we look at that and say, we really need to get back to a user fee user pays system when it comes to our highways, because truckers, while they're our biggest customers, are also our biggest competitors. And for us, it's kind of there's a competitive balance issue there when they're operating over a highly subsidized piece of infrastructure. And like we've discussed, we're covering the full cost of our infrastructure. So, you know, when we look at infrastructure investment, infrastructure finance, we think, you know, we don't only think through the rail spectrum, but we also look at the highway spectrum and think we really need to get back to that user pays. I know no one wants to raise the gas tax, but maybe we could start evolving towards a vehicle miles traveled fee or a weight distance fee. And that's actually something that's gained a lot of traction here in Washington recently.
Yeah, it appears you're frenemies with the trucking industry because you guys work with them.
Yeah.
With intermodal, which is something we're going to get into in a bit. But you also have some disagreements. And why don't you explain to us what some of those disagreements are between the trucking industry and rail, and where you guys can't really see eye to eye, but where there could be a possible solution, just like you outlined with the gas tax.
Right. So I would say there's healthy competition. How about that?
That's a good term.
the policy debates between rail and trucking have cooled off a bit in recent years. We used to get into some pretty big fights about the issues around truck size and weight. It goes back to this whole, you know, you need to be paying for your infrastructure before you're allowed to get increased productivity. And so we've had a number of fights on Capitol Hill about interests efforts to allow for heavier trucks or longer trucks. And rail's view is, again, you know, you guys are already getting a partially free ride on the highways. You shouldn't be allowed to gain further productivity by bigger, heavier trucks. Those fights they've kind of cooled off in the past few years. Honestly, that's not a political winner in a Democratic Congress. And so that, you know, we feel pretty well positioned in that one. And, you know, my counterpart over at the Trucking Association, I think he would say they're not pushing for truck productivity measures like that. You're right on the financing side, maybe we have some ideas that they haven't been super excited about embracing. I will give several of the bigger trucking companies credit. They have pushed to pay more into the Highway Trust Fund because, look, they need a high-performing highway system to be able to do their jobs. And the railroads need a high-performing highway system because of that intermodal piece. And so I'll give them credit. They've offered up increasing their payments into the gas tax. They haven't been quite as excited about our push on a weight VMT, but you know, I think they're open to ideas, and I credit them for coming around on some of this stuff. So, look, we all need to be able to work together because this country's freight needs are only going to continue to grow, and we have a lot of communities. You look at the last year, what this country's been through, you know, folks continued to need things 24/7 throughout the country, and truckers and railroaders were delivering those goods to them 24/7 throughout the year. So we all have to be working together.
Yeah. So I want to touch on that. How has the pandemic impacted freight railways? And I know obviously shipped goods, like you were saying, increased demand during this period. How has the industry been able to adjust and keep up with that increased demand? I know I heard something about a shipping container shortage. I don't know if you want to explain that to our listeners and kind of explain how that occurred. Any insights there?
Sure. Overall, you know, our industry was hit as every industry was about this time last year. We were fortunate in that we didn't see the business drop-offs that a lot of other industries did. We saw roughly around 30% of our traffic decline very quickly. Now, you know, that's a big hit, but it's nothing compared to what the airlines saw, for example. And so we are a well-capitalized industry, so we were built to withstand shocks like this. And so we saw a big hit, and that was due to pretty much everything across the board that we move. I would highlight automobiles, for example, with all the auto plants shutting down, about 75% of finished autos move on railroads. So that, you know, that entire business line just vaporized within, you know, a few weeks for about 6 weeks. But as we got in the middle of summer and late summer, volume started picking back up. And that's when we really saw the intermodal market just come roaring back. And that's the container traffic that is full of consumer goods. And if your house is anything like my house, it seems like an Amazon person visits about 5 times a day.
Yeah, so, I'm very familiar with that. Yeah.
You know, a lot of that
cardboard
stuff,
boxes just stacking up in this
house.
Oh
my gosh. to be in the cardboard industry, you were probably doing pretty well for yourself last year.
But, absolutely.
So we are moving a lot of those goods to supply centers, to distribution centers, pre-positioning them for Amazon and other e-commerce companies to then deliver via truck and other means. So intermodal has been huge. When you saw the plants reopen in China again mid last year, you know, there was such an overwhelming built up demand for goods that the West Coast ports were going gangbusters, and so much of that is going by rail into the heart of the country and across the country. And that's remained strong through the first quarter of this year. You mentioned the container shortage, and that is really a result of this overwhelming demand for consumer goods that continues. And you know, so much of this is coming from Asia. We're importing just colossal amounts of consumer goods right now, and there's only so many containers to go around, and traversing back and forth across the Pacific Ocean takes time. And you've got it's just when you see volumes spike that much, I think some of the maritime carriers were maybe caught slightly flat-footed, and there's just such a huge demand crunch right now. But we're still moving darn near record volumes of goods via intermodal, and you know, the system is still functioning at a very high level. We could all, you know, maritime trucking and railroads could probably all benefit from a few more containers out there.
No, absolutely. Now, we've mentioned intermodal a few times now during this podcast. Some people might not necessarily know what that is. Do you want to explain to us what it is and why it's so critical to the growth of freight?
Absolutely. So intermodal is, you know, it's container traffic. So when you see those massive ships coming, you know, across the Pacific Ocean, and they're stacked, you know, it seems like they've got several hundred stacked, you know, 10 containers high.
Yeah.
Those can either go by truck or they can go on the backs of rail cars. And the intermodal business is that. It's typically truck to rail to truck business, and it's filled. Those containers are filled with consumer goods. Sometimes they're filled with bulk items. Sometimes there's ag shipments moved in them. But by and large, it's consumer goods that are in those. And this country's, as we've said, demand for consumer goods has been so strong recently and continues to be, that just the volume of containers that needs to move around the country on any given day is massive. And rail is typically doing the long haul movement, and then truck is doing the movements on either side of that. And at this point, intermodal is about half of all rail business.
Wow.
It's remarkable how much it's grown in the past few decades. And that's where you see, you know, you mentioned the frenemies comment about rail and trucking. That's
yes,
where you
yes.
see really heavy duty competition, because, you know, there are natural splits. Once you get to a certain distance, it makes more sense to either move by rail or truck. But there's a lot of that margin traffic where either trucking based on its efficiencies or rail based on its efficiencies can really start to eat into those kind of mid-range movements around, you know, 300 to 500 miles. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we get into, you know, the debates about cost of infrastructure, paying for infrastructure, because one intermodal train can move over 200 trucks worth of goods.
Wow.
And so we feel like that's a win-win for not only rail, but also for communities in which we operate. That's trucks off the highways. That's less wear and tear on infrastructure. That's less emissions. That's less
yes.
fuel usage. So
absolutely.
Our goal is to do everything we can to pull every single container onto the rail for as long a distance or as short a distance as makes sense.
I mean, especially when you're talking about electrified or hydrogen powered rails, right? And you think about the potential impact that has on the environment, you know, taking 200 trucks off the roads. I mean, especially trucks that might be using diesel or other fossil fuels. So it kind of goes into the conversation here about climate change, right? What's the railroad's stance on climate change? And how do you think rail, besides, you know, the point you just outlined, is going to play a role in reducing emissions in this country?
So right now, rail moves about 40% of interstate traffic, freight traffic in this country. And we account for, I believe the exact number is 2.1% of transportation-related emissions. So the first pitch of our climate pitch is, if you want to reduce emissions right now, let's move as much as we can by rail, period. Day one, because you're inherently, like I just said, you're reducing emissions, you're reducing congestion because you have less trucks moving goods, but you also have less folks sitting in traffic. You're reducing wear and tear on infrastructure, and so that is a day one action that everything that moves, every container that moves on the back of a rail versus on the highway is reducing emissions, but. For the railroads, you know, it's not enough. We understand it's not enough to say just, you know, this is how we do things and we have an inherent advantage over emissions and fuel use. We have to continue to make progress ourselves. So you mentioned hydrogen-powered locomotives. I mentioned battery electric hybrid locomotives. Those are certainly, I'd be disingenuous if I said they were, you know, getting to a critical mass or a full maturity point and really making a difference.
Still emerging technology.
Definitely still emerging technology, but there's a lot of interest out there. There's a lot of proving going on to ensure the reliability. You're seeing a lot of different companies come out and take steps towards that next reality, because, you know, it makes good business for railroads too. One of their biggest expenses is fuel. So anything you can do to reduce fuel is going to reduce your overhead as well as provide environmental benefits. We're also taking steps in rail yards and ports to reduce emissions through the vehicles we're using, through the cranes, battery electric cranes that are moving the containers all over the place and positioning goods. And so there's a whole litany of activities that are going on. But near term, if you want to reduce emissions right now, let's get things off the highway and put them on the railroad.
Absolutely. And I know, you know, because of the pandemic at this point now, there's this American Jobs Plan that's being proposed and they're pledging to fix rail infrastructure. Do you have any insights that you can share with us on how this would impact your industry or consumer rail at all?
Sure. So one important thing and one important distinction to make is this country has, by leaps and bounds, the best freight railroad infrastructure in the world, hands down. And that's not me, the advocate, saying that. It's fact. It's documented. The American Society of Civil Engineers just reiterated that this past month. Where we need the investment is on the passenger side. Now, a lot of passenger rail does move on freight rail tracks. In fact, the majority of inner city Amtrak trains move on freight railroad tracks.
Oh,
so they get the benefit of that good infrastructure. When you look at, you know, again, we talked about the Northeast Corridor, desperate need for significant amounts of infrastructure investment. And so the plan put forward by President Biden would, I believe, it sets aside $40 billion out of about $80 billion in rail funding. So they see that national asset as something that's worthy of investment in. I completely agree with them. You see what's going on out in California with, you know, I know it's a long, slow moving. You probably can talk more about it than I can. The high speed rail project out in California.
One day.
But you know, I'm certain there are opportunities for additional funding there. What we're interested in, like I said, because of the nature of our, you know, paying for things ourselves, we approach infrastructure legislation a little different than other industries might. But again, we need a fully integrated, robust transportation logistics network in this country. So we need investment into ports. We need investment into highways. We need investment into connectors, intermodal connectors. And so there's absolutely a role for the public funding side of things. another
you know, just a little curious on those intermodal connectors. So the railroad industry is funding those right now, or is that a collaboration with the trucking industry? How do you guys fund those centers for intermodal?
So a lot of it's private, but when you're interacting with publicly owned facilities, for example, ports, most ports are at least, you know, quasi publicly owned or quasi privately owned, but there's definitely a major public aspect of them. So when private rail's connecting with a public port, then, you know, there's an opportunity, we think, for federal funding to help to help that make that as high performing as possible. So it is often a mix of public-private dollars in those sorts of interactions at those connectors, which has quite honestly made them maybe a little less easy to fund, because it's not just a clear, you need willing partners. You need a private side that's got skin in the game, and you need a public side that's willing to put skin in the game and has money to put into the game. And so that's why some of those projects are a little more challenging to do. But I would say legislators and the administration, this administration, prior administrations, have made a lot of progress as far as recognizing the value of those types of programs that put dollars into those types of projects.
Yeah, absolutely. Because at the end of the day, I mean, it creates jobs. It's good for the economy. It's good for the movement of goods. And it recognizes that we have a totally different economy today than we did even, you know, 10 years ago, right? The, you know, how e-commerce has revolutionized how people shop. And, you know, I'm sure we're consuming a lot more imported goods, and we need to find a way to get them across the country. And also recognizing that we all don't, you know, especially during the pandemic, we saw people move out of cities and move into, you know, let's say, for example, the Mountain West, right? Which had not really been a very populous area before then. It's picking up steam. People, you know, want to move to new places, and it's going to be essential to kind of have that infrastructure for transporting not just goods, but also people, like you were mentioning.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the Mountain West, for example, you're exactly right. You know, the whole Mountain West into the Sun Belt are absolutely booming areas now. And we're fortunate that a lot of rail, you know, from this might sound silly, but from the Western expansion and, you know, the establishment of the Transcontinental Railroad, a lot of towns built up around where the rail line was. And so there's an inherent infrastructure running right into the heart of a lot of these areas that are growing so much. So it's almost it's not serendipitous, because it all happened for a reason. But rail is almost, you know, pre-positioned to help support the growth of these areas that are starting to boom so much now.
Yeah. One thing I was going to ask you, because we briefly touched on passenger rail. I know, you know, the bread and butter of the industry is freight, but I do want to touch on passenger, because it is a bit exciting when you see some of these. I don't know if you've been on Twitter lately or social media, but there's been these maps that outline like a dream, you know, high speed rail system that would connect the entire U.S. What do you think are the challenges that high-speed rail and passenger rail have had? Because, you know, I think, like you said, the penetration of passenger rail is significantly lower outside of the Northeast Corridor. Why do you think there hasn't been a lot of movement in terms of creating high-speed rail solutions, you know, et cetera? Any thoughts there?
It's all about a lack of willingness to make the necessary investments. You know, you look at the passenger systems in Europe or the passenger systems in Japan or China, well, those are the result of billions upon billions of dollars in public investment. And those are countries that have made the decision that, you know, this is something our society desires and something our society is determined is worthy of investment. And when you look at US, you know, Amtrak, who is the predominant intercity passenger rail provider in this country, I think they're celebrating their 50th anniversary. And as of a few years ago, I think they had gotten something like $40 billion total from the federal government over, you know, 40 plus years. That's about as much as the highway system gets per year. And that is enough to keep the system limping along, and I actually give Amtrak credit. They've done a lot with the money they've been provided. We talked about the penetration in the Northeast Corridor, but if you're really going to stand up, you know, a world-class high-speed rail system, it's going to take a sustained commitment of significant public investment. As I said, a lot of passenger rail operates on freight lines right now, but freight rail is very different than high-speed passenger rail. The actual rail we're talking about. So, you know, our systems are built to let trains run about 75, 76 miles an hour. And you can't slap a train on one of our tracks and expect it to go, you know, 200 miles an hour. So that requires literally the build out of a new system. So again, it takes the sustained commitment and planning and funding from policymakers in this country. And so, you know, we can keep making incremental progress. You know, we mentioned the much maligned California project.
Yes.
But and that's fine. You know, we can go bit by bit, and hopefully we can get the NEC in a state of good repair. But to get what I think most people have in their minds as far as high speed rail, it is going to take a lot of money and a long time and a lot of commitment. And until our country or demands that legislators do that, it's going to be tough to get there.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think the other thing is that the, you know, air industry and the car and the automotive industry, they have such a role in, you know, also lobbying the government, and their industries depend on having a robust roads. Air
right.
industry, you know, they have their interest as well. So I mean, I still dream about the day I can just get into a high-speed rail and get to, you know, from here to San Francisco in like 2 hours, cut down on the driving, be able to visit all my friends in the Bay Area. But I know
right.
that there's some movement on the private end, and I'm sure you know way more about this than I do, building a rail line from the high desert over here in mm-hmm. Southern California to Las Vegas. And mm-hmm. I think that's a privately funded project. So that might be a step in the right direction, where if that is a viable, you know, project that people use and people love, I'm sure it'll encourage the government to really look at where we're spending money on rail, right?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It was historically called the Desert Express. I think it's under a different name now, but you do have a few proposed projects out there, and I think they're actually supposed to break ground on the LA Basin to Las Vegas line this year. And so what you have there is you have that highway infrastructure. So you have the right of way that is mm-hmm. exists. It's largely uninterrupted because you're going out across the high desert, as you mentioned. So then it's okay. Does it make economic sense for a private company to come in and fund that and expect they can get a return on their investment that makes it all worthwhile? And so there are pockets out there where there seems to be an appetite for that. Desert Express, I think there's a project in Texas.
Yes.
There's one in Florida. Which is the Eastern, I think it's, there's some of the same companies involved with the one in Florida and the Desert Express. And so a lot of that comes down to, okay, we have the right of way in place for one reason or another. And then, so that takes care of what is a major, major hurdle. And then, you know, can you rough out the economics to make the investment make sense? Where policymakers can really be helpful or harmful is in kind of the project delivery permitting side of things that allows the project to proceed in a coherent, timely manner. So, you know, I guess I probably didn't quite give enough credence to some of those projects out there, because I'm excited to see where they go. Just, you know, I'm sure there's a huge market of folks in Southern California who would love to hop on a train and, you know, start having a good time before they get into Las Vegas versus sitting in traffic for 4 hours. So,
yes. Imagine slot machines.
Oh my gosh.
You know, by the way, is gambling still a thing on passenger rail? Was it ever a thing? if it's not, maybe it should be.
You know, there's another revenue stream. There you go.
Yeah.
I don't know how that works with the interstate commerce laws and things like that. But, you know, look, I'm sure plenty of gambling has occurred on passenger trains. Whether or not it's been legal is probably a different story. But regulated gambling, not that I'm aware of.
All right. Well, Ian Jeffries, it's been a pleasure. I hope you can join us again sometime in the future and give us an update on, you know, freight rail and all this stuff. But this was absolutely fascinating. If you want to learn more about the Association of American Railroads, let me pull up the website real quick. I should have had this ready. You can go to AAR.org. There you go. Association of American Railroads. Thanks again, Ian. This has been incredible. And yeah, hopefully you can join us again sometime in the future.
Yeah, I'd love to. I really enjoyed it and great talking with you, and a lot of exciting things going on in transportation across the board. So this is a great podcast y'all are doing.
Absolutely. Thank you for the kind words, and we'll see you all next week. Thanks for listening to Inside Transportation, and yeah, thank you.